I sometimes like to tell a story which offers a contemporary parallel before looking back at the occurrences and teachings during Lord Buddha's life. I recently saw a mini documentary about a type of rock climbing, or rather cliff face climbing, called free solo. As Buddhist practitioners, we all wish to be free. And the word solo has interesting connotations. Solitude. As we cultivate samadhi, it's recommended that we have gaya viveka, solitude of the body, so that we can establish citta viveka, a mind which is aloof from the five hindrances. So those two words, free and solo, caught my attention. What's interesting about this documentary is it just showed the success of one rather epic cliff face climb. So there's a man in California called Alex Hollands, and he had a dream that he would climb a cliff face in Yosemite National Park. The name of the mountain is El Capitan, the captain. The cliff face is 3,200 feet high and practically vertical. And so this documentary shows this young man climbing up this cliff face. And in the world of cliff climbing, free and solo means no rope and no safety equipment at all. And so he starts, he finds a crack in a granite cliff face, and he's got shoes which are kind of soft but they have grip, and all he has is a chalk pack that he dips his hand in every now and then so that the sweat doesn't make it slippery. And sure enough, he climbs up and up and up. Sometimes, most remarkably, it's not even vertical, he has to go outwards, literally hanging upside down for a few steps, with his feet and fingers in cracks before getting over the bump. And beautifully filmed, so I watched that. It was very interesting. Beautiful nature, and this man that just climbed up a cliff face, and he made it in 3 hours 56 minutes. I noticed the quality of mindfulness, the quality of energy, the quality of focus, a kind of samadhi, other noble qualities such as determination, patience. So I was interested in this character. So I noticed that there was a TED talk where he talked about how he prepared for this epic accomplishment. So it turns out that he had climbed that rock face 50 times with ropes. And he had memorized the path that he would take step by step. And he had rehearsed the difficult parts, the parts that you watch when you just see the final goal and you think, oh my goodness, that is not humanly possible. Is he an extraterrestrial? What planet is he from? Well, he had studied those difficult parts and he rehearsed in the gym and at various other places on the beach, rocky overhangs where one had to go outwards hanging upside down with the feet hanging on in between cracks. So it's a very interesting parable, because the sutta I'm about to read is the one where at the end of the sermon, 1,000 matted hair fire worshipping ascetics all become arahants. And so we can look at this and we can think, how is it possible? How is it possible that these people, having listened to just one sermon, drop all of the fetters and attain to complete liberation? And we understand that any truly remarkable accomplishment in this world is accomplished through discipline, patient endurance, not giving up. So apparently this man prepared for 7 years, and I think in the final 2 years, went up that mountain 50 times and obviously had quite remarkable sati and samadhi because he could remember every step. When he was interviewed, they asked him, why did you want to do this? And he said it was the most difficult one that he could do, and he wanted to feel that he had mastered his art. Not only did he want to feel that he had mastered his art, he wanted to do it masterfully. So that meant from the first step at the bottom of the cliff to the final step to not feel frightened or unsure about what to do. So when he got to the top, he looked very pleased with himself, and he later said the one part which was truly dangerous, he said, because the people filming were apparently much more frightened than he was. And he says, there's no people looking at the screens. It's very interesting, there's people filming, there's a lot of cameras. But they had to stay out of his way and they had to not interrupt him, because literally one slip and this man is dead. And it'll be on camera, it'll be awful. So the camera people obviously very concerned to stay out of his way, and they'd have plenty of time in all of the rehearsals to find places to put the camera and stay quiet. So there are some scenes where the cameraman couldn't look at his screen. But the climber said it wasn't until the last 500 meters, which is the easiest part, that he nearly made a mistake, because he said he thought, that's the best climb that anybody ever climbed, I'm the man. And then he thought, hang on, you're not finished yet. So a little bit of pride, a little bit of vanity could have caused him to trip, but he did have mindfulness, he was aware not to do that. And similarly, we think of the Tibetans that circumambulate Mount Kailash. They consider Mount Kailash to be the center of the universe in Buddhist cosmology, Mount Meru. And they consider that to circumambulate Mount Meru, it's purifies negative karma. Biggest challenge about Mount Kailash is I think it begins at, the lowest elevation is 4,300 meters and the highest is 5,500. And at the 5,500 meter pass, there is half the oxygen that there is at sea level. So I remember Brother Semedo, in his 60s I think, did circumambulate Mount Kailash, and it's very cold at night in summer and very hot in the day, just to give you an example of how dangerous it can be. Brother Semedo went to sleep in his tent and there was a bit of a blizzard, some wind, some snow. Wake up in the morning, time to go and have breakfast, and the donkey had died and was a piece of ice. That's how cold it was. So again, these people cultivating patience, determination, effort, and some of these Tibetan practitioners do the three steps, one bow, full bow, lying down on the rocks. So a normal kora takes 3 or 4 days. I think it's about 45 kilometers. To do three steps, one bow takes 2 weeks. So human beings are capable of extraordinary focus and determination, acts of faith. One can't help wondering, of course, or thinking, what would it be like if we could apply that kind of discipline to our spiritual life? A kind of just dogged, determined, not looking back, just doing it, memorizing step by step with unflinching determination to reach the goal. So actually we're all working towards that, because it's not possible to have that attitude from ground zero, as it were, from base camp. We do have to train. Virya Bharami, effort. The way that we develop effort is by making more effort and lifting our game little by little, but very importantly, not allowing a kind of a slipping back. Or if we do slip back, we have to get back up quickly. So I would like to suggest that the matted hair fire-worshipping ascetics had this quality of ruthless, relentless, focused determination. I'd also suggest that as people who tended sacrificial fires, I would think that they would have what is called the fire kasina, where a meditator takes the fire element as their meditation and is able to absorb on the perception or on the fire element. It's a type of jhana, samadhi. It often results in having certain psychic powers, particularly the capacity to read the thoughts of others. And so the reason I mention this is that because Lord Buddha, before he taught these 1,000 ascetics, displayed a lot of his psychic powers. And it's important to have a sense of context. These are 1,000 Olympic-grade meditators, many of them with probably a lot of psychic power. And their leader, very famous, had royal patronage. So it wasn't going to be easy to win over 1,000 Olympic-grade meditators, so one should understand the Buddha is not showing off. In this context, Lord Buddha is using the appropriate method, and you can see by the result. So the other reason I mention this is I don't think it's legend. Some people read these kind of things and they think, oh, they decorated this afterwards, you know, there probably weren't 1,000. The Buddha probably didn't use his psychic powers, and he probably gave those teachings, but I think it's a bit exaggerated. And I don't think so. We think of the Bodhisattva spending millions of lives cultivating qualities and generating merit, and then the millions of beings who cultivate virtue and grow in goodness, in dependence upon him as a leader. Then naturally, a lot of people with deep karmic connections to the Buddha who have developed themselves a great deal. Just the example of Ajahn and myself during this retreat, sitting with you for about 5.5 or 6 hours a day, teaching for an hour a day, one guided meditation, another 45 minutes of answering questions, an hour and a half of chanting together. Just imagine we did that for the next 100,000 lives. And suppose it went from 8 days to 80 days to 8 years to 80 years. Then I would suggest that we would all become rather impressive. I'm not making any commitment to this, but just saying. So anyway, that was a little bit of background. Now I'll read the events leading up to the teaching and the teaching. So Lord Buddha has already taught the 5 disciples. They've become arahants. And then he taught Yasa, the merchant, and Yasa's friends. When the Blessed One had lived at Benares as long as he chose, he set out to wander by stages to Uruvela. The Blessed One journeyed on by stages till he at length arrived at Uruvela. Now at that time, 3 matted hair ascetics were living at Uruvela called Kasapa of Uruvela, Kasapa of the River, and Kasapa of Gaya. Kasapa of Uruvela was the leader, guide, chief head, and principal of 500 matted hair ascetics, Kasapa of the River of 300, and Kasapa of Gaya of 200. The Blessed One went to the hermitage of Kasapa of Uruvela, and he said, "Kasapa, if you have no objection, I should like to spend one night in your fire chamber." "I have no objection, great monk, but there is a savage royal Naga serpent there. He has supernormal powers. He is venomous, fearfully poisonous, and capable of killing you." The Blessed One asked a second time and a third time and received the same reply, and he said, "Perhaps he will not destroy me, Kasapa, so grant me the fire chamber." "Then stay there as long as you like, great monk." So the Blessed One went into the fire chamber. He spread out a rush mat and sat down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness in front of him. When the Naga saw the Blessed One come in, he was angry, and he produced smoke. Then the Blessed One thought, "Suppose I counter his fire by fire, without injuring his outer skin or inner skin or flesh or sinews or bones or marrow," and he did so, and he produced smoke. Then the Naga, no longer restraining his fury, produced flames. The Blessed One entered upon the fire element and produced flames too. The fire chamber seemed to burn and blaze and glow with their flames. The Matadhir ascetics gathered round and they said, "The great monk who is so beautiful is being destroyed by the Naga." When the night was over and the Blessed One had encountered the Naga's fire by fire without injuring him, he put him into his bowl and showed him to Uruvelakasapa. "This is your Naga, Kasapa. His fire has been counted by fire." Then Uruvelakasapa thought, "The great monk is very mighty and powerful since he is able to counter by fire the fire of the savage royal Naga, serpent with supernormal powers who is venomous, fearfully poisonous, but he is not an arahant like me." The Blessed One then went to live in a wood not far from Kasapa's hermitage. When the night was well advanced, the four divine kings, marvelous to see and illuminating the whole wood, went to the Blessed One. And after paying homage to him, they stood at the four quarters like pillars of fire. When the night was over, the Matadhir ascetic Uruvelakasapa went to the Blessed One and said, "It is time, great monk. The meal is ready. Who were those that came to you in the night?" "They were the divine kings of the four quarters, Kasapa. They came to me to hear the Dhamma." So that's the... When you walk into this temple, you'll notice the Maitreya statue in the front and the four deities, protecting deities. That's the four kings, Chatu Maharaja in Pali. So they came to show honor and guard the Buddha personally. Kasapa thought, "The great monk is very mighty and powerful since the divine kings come to him to hear the Dhamma, but he is not an arahant like me." So Mr. Kasapa is a little bit deluded. But his delusion is probably based upon quite a few talents, I would think. He does have 500 disciples, so he probably has some psychic power, I think so. On subsequent nights, Saka, ruler of gods, and Brahma Sahampati came to the Blessed One. They were seen by Kasapa, and the sequel was the same. It was at this time that Uruvelakasapa's great sacrificial ceremony fell due, and people from all Anga and Magadha came eagerly, bringing large quantities of various kinds of food. Then Kasapa thought, "Now my great sacrificial ceremony falls due, and people from all Anga and Magadha are coming, eagerly bringing large quantities of various kinds of food. If the great monk works a marvel before all of these people, his gain and renown will increase and mine will diminish. If only the great monk were not to come tomorrow." So here we see clearly pride and competitiveness. So of the kilesas, 16 upakilesa, pride is one, competitiveness is another. The Blessed One became aware in his mind of the thought in Kasapa's mind, so he went to the northern continent of Uttarakuru and gathered alms food there. Then he took the alms food to the Himalayan lake of Anuttata, where he ate it and passed the day. When the night was over, Kasapa went to the Blessed One and said, "It is time, great monk, the meal is ready. Why did the great monk not come yesterday? We wondered why you did not come. Your portion of food was laid out." The Blessed One told him. Then Kasapa thought, "The great monk is very mighty and powerful since he was aware in his mind of the thought in my mind. But he's not an arahant like me." When the Blessed One had eaten Uruvelakasapa's meal, he went back to live in the same wood. Now at that time a refuse rag came into the Blessed One's possession and he thought, "What shall I wash the refuse rag?" Originally robes were made from leftover rags, the monk's robes. Then Saka, ruler of gods, became aware in his mind of the thought in the Blessed One's mind. He scooped out a pond with his hand, and he told the Blessed One, "Lord, let the Blessed One wash the refuse rag here." Next the Blessed One thought, "What shall I beat the refuse rag on?" Then Saka, ruler of gods, aware in his mind of the thought in the Blessed One's mind, set down a large stone. "Lord, let the Blessed One beat the refuse rag here." Next, the Blessed One thought, "What shall I hang the refuse rag on?" Then a deity living in a kakuda tree bent down a branch. "Lord, let the Blessed One hang the refuse rag here." Next, the Blessed One thought, "What shall I smooth the refuse rag on?" Then Saka, ruler of the gods, set down a large stone. "Lord, let the Blessed One smooth the refuse rag here." When the night was over, Kasapa went to the Blessed One and said, "It is time, great monk, the meal is ready." "But great monk, how does this pond come to be here that was not here before? Who set down this stone that was not here before? How is this kakuda branch bent down that was not bent down before?" The Blessed One told him what had occurred. Sankasapa thought, please say it. The great monk is very mighty and powerful since Saka, ruler of gods, waits on him, but... Again, when the night was over, Kaspa went to the Blessed One and told him, it is time, great monk, the meal is ready. The Blessed One dismissed him, saying, go, Kaspa, I shall follow. He went to the rose apple tree, after which the rose apple continent of India is called, Jambudvipa, and he secured a fruit. Then he arrived first and sat down in the fire chamber. Kaspa saw him sitting there, and he asked, great monk, what road did you come by? I left before you. But you have arrived before me and are sitting here in the fire chamber. The Blessed One told him where he had been, and he added, here is a rose apple. It is colored and has scent and taste. Eat it if you like. No, great monk, you bought it. You should eat it. Then Kaspa thought, the great monk is very mighty and powerful since he sends me off first and then goes to the rose apple tree, secures a fruit, arrives here before me, and is sitting in the fire chamber. But... Again, on like occasions, the Blessed One went to the rose apple tree and secured a mango from a tree nearby, secured a gall nut from a tree nearby, secured a yellow gall nut from a tree nearby, went to the heaven of the 33 and secured a flower from the Parichataka tree, and each time Kaspa had the same thought as before. It was at this time that the Matatera ascetics, wanting to maintain their fires, found themselves unable to split logs. Then they thought, it must be because of the great monk's supernormal power that we cannot split logs. The Blessed One asked Kaspa, should the logs be split, Kaspa? They should be split, great monk. At once, the 500 logs were split. Then Kaspa thought, the great monk is very mighty and powerful since the logs could not be split, but he is not an arahant like me. So, thinking of samadhi and the power of samadhi. So Lord Buddha has said that of all the psychic powers that he respects most is the psychic power of teaching people how to liberate themselves from the power of greed, hatred and delusion. And later on, when he gives his sermon, that is what he will do. But in the process of developing a lot of samadhi, a lot of wisdom, psychic powers are also developed if one simply practices for long enough. So here we're talking about thousands of lives. So if one has a rupa jhana, that means not the first four jhanas, the fifth, sixth, seventh and eighth, they're so subtle and they're so powerful, one actually develops a mastery over the four elements. The mind can separate from and then actually control. So there are things like walking on water, walking in the air, swimming in the earth. And there was an occasion where Lord Buddha taught what's called the twin miracle, and only a Buddha can do this. And I think it was an occasion where there were other sectarians that were saying that he wasn't gifted, he wasn't special, and I think it was near Savatthi, where the base monastery was. And so he decided on that occasion he would show them once and for all what he was capable of. And so he levitated into the air, and he radiated fire from one half of his body while radiating water from the other half. And apparently only a Buddha can do that, so sadhu. But I don't think this is a legend or myth or hyperbole. I think this is what happened, and this is just a part of what a Buddha can do. And again, on like occasions, the Matatera ascetics, wanting to maintain their fire, could likewise not light their fires, could likewise not put out their fires, and each time Kaspa had the same thoughts as before. As that time too, on those cold wintry nights during the 8 days of frost, the Matatera ascetics were immersing themselves in the river Niranjara and emerging from it, constantly immersing and emerging. Then the Blessed One created 500 braziers for the Matatera ascetics to warm themselves at when they came up out of the water, and they thought, these braziers must have been created by the great monk's supernormal power. Then Kaspa thought, the great monk is very mighty and powerful since he has created so many braziers, but he's not an arahant like me. About that time too, a great rainstorm burst out of season and produced a huge inundation. The place where the Blessed One was living was all under water. Then he thought, suppose I made the waters stand back all around so that I could walk in between on dry ground, and he did so. Kaspa thought, I hope the great monk has not been carried away by the water, and he went by boat with a number of Matatera ascetics to the place where the Blessed One was living. He saw that the Blessed One had made the waters stand back all around and was walking in between on dry ground. When he saw, he said, "Is that you, great monk?" "It is I, Kassapa." The Blessed One rose up into the air and came to rest on the boat. Then Kassapa thought, "The great monk is very mighty, since even the water has not overcome him, but he is not an arahant." Then the Blessed One thought, "This misguided man will go on forever thinking, but he is not an arahant like me. Suppose I give him a shock." As if one wouldn't be shocked already. He told Arivela Kassapa, "Kassapa, you are neither an arahant, nor are you on your way to becoming one. There is nothing that you do by which you might become an arahant or enter into the way to becoming one." Now that would be very humbling, wouldn't it? But sometimes we need to be humbled. Thereupon the Matadhara ascetic prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he said to him, "Lord, I wish to receive the going forth and the admission from the Blessed One." So you can see it was probably more like denial that was affecting his mind, wasn't it? As soon as he let go of his denial, he's on his knees. "Okay, Lord, let me be your disciple." But Kassapa, you are the leader, guide, chief, head, and principal of 500 Matadhara ascetics. You must consult them first so that they may do as they think fit. So Uruvela Kassapa went to the other Matadhara ascetics and told them, "I want to lead the holy life under the great monk. You may do as you think fit." They replied, not surprisingly, "We have long had faith in the great monk. If you lead the holy life under him, all of us will do likewise." Then the Matadhara ascetics took their hair, their matted locks, and their belongings, and the furniture of the fire sacrifice, and they dropped them into the water to be carried away. They then went to the Blessed One, and prostrating themselves with their heads at his feet, they said, "Lord, we wish to receive the going forth and the admission from the Blessed One." "Come, bhikkhus," the Blessed One said, "the Dhamma is well proclaimed. Lead the holy life for the complete ending of suffering." And that was those Venerable Ones' full admission. So the very first bhikkhus, they are called ehi bhikkhus. What that means is, Lord Buddha just said this phrase, "Come bhikkhu." That was the extent of the ordination ceremony. And it also illustrates the fact that they were so ripe and ready and well prepared that basically they knew what to do. He just says, "Come bhikkhu." And then they get their robes, get their bowl, and they knew how to behave perfectly. The Matadhara ascetic Kassapa of the river saw the hair, the matted locks, and the belongings and the furniture of the fire sacrifice being carried along by the water, and he thought, "I hope no disaster has befallen my brother." He sent Matadhara ascetics, "Go and find out about my brother." And he went off himself with his 300 Matadhara ascetics to the Venerable Uruvela Kassapa, and he asked him, "Is this better, Kassapa?" "Yes, friend, this is better." Then those Matadhara ascetics took their hair, their matted locks, and their belongings, and the furniture of the fire sacrifice, and they dropped them into the water to be carried away. Then they went to the Blessed One, and prostrating themselves with their heads at his feet, they asked for and received the going forth and the admission. And the Matadhara ascetic Kassapa of Gaya, with 200 Matadhara ascetics, did just as Kassapa of the river had done. The next part, Mara comes to see Lord Buddha. It's very interesting that even though Lord Buddha is enlightened and now he has many other enlightened disciples, Mara still comes along. And the usual thing, "You're not enlightened. No, 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 no." And the Buddha is like, "Yes, I am." And Mara leaves disappointed. Now, after staying at Uruvela for as long as he chose, the Blessed One set out for Gayasesa with a large following of bhikkhus, with 1,000 bhikkhus, with all the former Matadhara ascetics. The Blessed One stopped at Gayasesa near Gaya, together with 1,000 bhikkhus. Then he addressed the bhikkhus thus. So we're going to go through the fire sermon now, which is the one we chanted this morning and last night. We've been talking quite a bit about the five spiritual powers. We should understand that as the Buddha gives this instruction, these bhikkhus have them well established, and they just need to apply them. They need to apply the mindfulness to be right mindfulness, and the wisdom to be directed, and they are quick to understand. Thus have I heard. At one time the Blessed One was staying near Gaya at Gaya Head, together with 1,000 bhikkhus. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, everything is burning, and what, bhikkhus, is everything that is burning?" Keeping in mind, these are the fire-worshipping ascetics, and he's using the metaphor of fire. The eye bhikkhus is burning, forms are burning, eye consciousness is burning, eye contact is burning. The feeling that arises from eye contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too is burning. With what is it burning? I declare that it is burning with the fires of passion, hatred and delusion. It is burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. The ear is burning, sounds are burning, ear consciousness is burning, ear contact is burning. The feeling that arises from ear contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too is burning. With what is it burning? I declare that it is burning with the fires of passion, hatred and delusion. It is burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. The nose is burning, odors are burning, nose consciousness is burning, nose contact is burning. The feeling that arises from nose contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too is burning. With what is it burning? I declare that it is burning with the fires of passion, hatred and delusion. It is burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. The tongue is burning, tastes are burning, tongue consciousness is burning, tongue contact is burning. The feeling that arises from tongue contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too is burning. With what is it burning? I declare that it is burning with the fires of passion, hatred and delusion. It is burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. And so similarly with the body is burning, tangible objects are burning. Similarly with the mind is burning, mental states are burning. With what are they burning? Burning with the fires of passion, hatred and delusion, birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Seeing this bhikkhus, the wise, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with the eye and disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with eye consciousness and disenchanted with eye contact. And the feeling that arises from eye contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too they become disenchanted with. Another word could be not fascinated with, not obsessed with, not deluded by. They become disenchanted with the ear, disenchanted with sounds, disenchanted with ear consciousness, disenchanted with ear contact and the feeling that arises from ear contact. Whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too they become disenchanted with. They become disenchanted with the nose, disenchanted with odors, disenchanted with nose consciousness and disenchanted with nose contact. And the feeling that arises from nose contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too they become disenchanted with. They become disenchanted with the tongue, same as before, disenchanted with taste, etc. They become disenchanted with the body, disenchanted with tangible objects. And finally, they become disenchanted with the mind, disenchanted with mental states, disenchanted with mind consciousness, disenchanted with mind contact, and the feeling that arises from mind contact, whether it is pleasant, painful or neutral, that too they become disenchanted with. Another one of these fabulous paragraphs. Becoming disenchanted, their passions fade away. With the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. With liberation, there comes the knowledge it is liberated and they know. Destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived out. Done is what had to be done, there is no more coming into any state of being. Thus spoke the Blessed One, delighted, the bhikkhus rejoiced in what the Lord had said. Moreover, while the discourse was being uttered, the minds of those 1,000 bhikkhus were freed from the defilements without any further attachment. And then you have 1,000 more arahants in the world. So we considered a very similar paragraph yesterday at the end of the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the discourse on not self, that becoming disenchanted, their passions fade away. Viraga is the Pali for dispassion. Nibida, nibindati is like weariness, becoming weary. So when a person is still completely deluded, they have an assumption that bodies and minds are going to fulfill happiness and pleasure, and they're seeking pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant tastes, pleasant feelings, pleasant mind states. As long as we're completely committed to that, we're not yet going to feel weary and disenchanted. We might suffer a great deal and we might feel very frustrated, but we don't yet feel a suitable level of weariness because we're still deludedly, completely committed to it, trying to squeeze as much happiness as we can, trying to rearrange the furniture on the deck of the Titanic, as it were. But it is always sinking. So it's only when a being starts to really pay attention and stops projecting onto samsara an agenda. Because samsara doesn't go how you want it to. Have you noticed? Has anybody noticed? Is anybody's samsara going just how they planned? Nobody's nodding. Mine hasn't so far. It's like that looking for the sweet chili with the tears rolling down your face. Mm-hmm. Keep eating them, looking for the sweet one. So in simply paying attention to the way things are, rather than having an agenda or being deludedly committed to trying to perceive them other than how they are, the normal response, healthy response, is to become weary of it all. And to understand that there's only so much pleasure that can be gained from this, and it's not very much. And the pleasure is always fleeting, disintegrating, changing. Happiness becomes suffering. Those that we fall in love with, sometimes we fall out of love with them, sometimes they fall out of love with us, sometimes we get separated from them through aging, illness and death. So worldly happiness never lasts. The good news is, in contemplating in these ways and seeing things as they are, conditioned phenomena, that which is unconditioned, mindful awareness, or the awareness that mindfulness leads us to experience, that becomes more developed, because delusion is a darkening quality, ignorance is a darkening quality. As ignorance and delusion is weakened through simply paying attention with mindfulness to conditions the way they are, our delusion, our misunderstanding of them, falls away from the mind. It becomes thinner and thinner, and so what happens is the mind becomes more radiant, more powerful, more peaceful, more wise. And a radiant, powerful, peaceful, and wise mind experiences a lot of rapture, a lot of tranquility, a lot of peace, and the bliss of equanimity. So as you mature spiritually and you see that worldly phenomena are not worth pursuing, not worth being fascinated with, and that the spiritual path is a more dependable mountain to climb, as it were, then the more practice you do, the more strict you are with your precepts, the more meditation you do, as you see with wisdom and you're able to contain your desires and let go of them and experience a mind which is not affected by the five hindrances, initially affected by the five hindrances much less, and then eventually not affected by them at all, when one is truly adept at samadhi, then, so it doesn't quite say this, it doesn't say, which is why I'm adding a little bit by way of commentary, it says that their passions fade away, and with the fading of passion the heart is liberated, but I just wanted to point a little bit to what would the qualities of a liberated heart be. So sometimes people have this kind of nihilistic sense, destroy the self view, get rid of greed, hatred and delusion, purify the mind. It's good to remember that the purified mind experiences unshakable peace. And all of these people having quite good samadhi, amazing blissful meditation, and then when they ask the arahants, is this better? They answer, it's better. If it wasn't better, they wouldn't give up their attachment to the samadhi. So obviously the bliss of the liberated mind is superior even to jhana samadhi. So it's just nice to give some thought to what the experience of the goal would be. That the mind is purified, the mind is liberated, a liberated mind experiences unshakable peace. And so I offer these words for your reflection and encouragement, and I hope that you develop and grow in your five spiritual powers, and that they lead to the deathless and merge in the deathless, and that you may experience, how does it go? that you may be disenchanted, that your passions may fade, and with the fading of passion that your heart may be liberated. And then you will say, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, done is what had to be done, there is no more coming into any state of being. And then we will say, sadhu.